Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows and reaper drones of those who make outrageous fortunes from the suicide bomb of fossil fuel. Sacrifice zone for the 1% in their green zones.
To be or not to be, to be or not to be. To be or not to be,
to be engaged in this existential struggle.
To be or not to be,
between life on earth and an economic model, or to take arms against a rising sea of troubles, and by opposing them from the ground.
By the axis of descent, on behalf of the 99%.
We'll take our power from the wind and sun,
and leave the oil in the ground.
Demand clean air and fresh clean water,
and leave the oil in the ground.
And we'll be singing, die, 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 capitalism must die. Fossil fuel has added far too good,
far too long.
But all things must pass, all things decay.
Starting today,
the lack of separation between state and corporation
has way past itself by day.
So die neoliberalism, miasma capital.
And good morning once again. Here we are, Wednesday Talk Radio. My name's Paul Rowland. Be with you until 9 o'clock when Political Perspectives comes your way. A more appropriate song I cannot think of for the programming coming up, To Be or Not to Be by Dan Burt, No Bacon, and the Axis of Descent. Dan Burt, of course, ex of the great Chumbawamba. So we have two very special guests here this morning from Eugene, Oregon. Our Children's Trust lead attorney, Julie Olson, and lead youth plaintiff, Kelsey Giuliana. Before I do the introduction, just a couple quick announcements. You heard on Democracy Now!, and you've been here and there, and hopefully you've been paying attention on social media because you're not getting it on the mainstream media. There's going to be a fundraiser for the Sacred Stone Camp and Resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline. That's this evening here in Portland, 6 to 7:30 p.m. at Peninsula Park, North Ainsworth and Albina. Here's your chance to boost the resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline at Sacred Stone and support the indigenous-led environmental protection work that's happening right here in Portland. Come to a dessert fundraiser and donate what you can in a raffle, plus meet folks from around the area who are supporting this work also. That's this evening, 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the gazebo at Peninsula Park in Portland. You go to their Facebook page for more about that. Also this Friday, Casualties of Endless War, Lives, Compassion, the Economy, Privacy, and the Environment rally in March, marking 15 years since 9/11. Pioneer Courthouse Square this Friday, September 9th, 5 p.m. For more info, go to Peace and Justice, Justice Works Iraq Affinity Group. And, of course, there's another number of other events, some of them sponsored by KBOO. You can hear them here on KBOO. Go to kboo.fm, look under community events. So, as I said, an unprecedented legal challenge to the entire fossil fuel industry, government regulatory agencies, and federal climate and energy policy is slowly making its way through the federal courts. And for now, it's right here in Oregon, in Eugene, U.S. District Court. Kelsey Cascade Rose Giuliana et al. Versus the United States of America et al., which was filed last year, survived a motion to dismiss this past spring. Next Tuesday, September 13th, Judge Ann Aiken will hear further oral arguments in the case as she reviews Magistrate Judge Thomas Coffin's ruling in the plaintiff's favor. The 21 youth plaintiffs backed by Our Children's Trust law firm have taken on the challenge of holding the government accountable for failing to act effectively and decisively to curb the emissions of greenhouse gases that are heating up the planet and destabilizing the Earth's climate system. The lawsuit is based on the youth's fundamental constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property into the future, all of which are threatened by government complicity with the fossil fuel industry and inaction in adequately regulating it. So, good morning, Julia Olson. Are you with us?
Good morning.
Good morning. And good morning, Kelsey.
Good morning.
And so let's just jump right into this. I kind of wanted to start. We'll have a full hour to talk about the what's been happening with the lawsuit, the background. But I just want to talk briefly about what's going on in North Dakota. I'm sure that's on your minds as well, because to me, the fundamental problem, why they're only, you know, this is not to minimize in any way the importance, which is paramount to the Native American people, of their cultural sites, their burial sites, their prayer sites, which are being threatened. But the reason why that's the only question that can be addressed currently in court is because there's no environmental impact statement for the pipeline. And the reason there's no environmental impact statement is because there's almost no regulation of oil pipelines. They're treated as public utilities. And so they're able to get eminent domain on that basis and get people's land and pass this 1,100-mile pipeline through there. And they're also they don't have to go through the regular environmental evaluation process that most other large projects do. That's on the one hand. On the other, if there was an actual climate policy that your lawsuit is trying to make the government have, they would also have to take into consideration the impacts on the climate of such large projects. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah. Thank you for mentioning the Dakota Access Pipeline or Bakken Oil Pipeline fight that's currently going on with Standing Rock Reservation. I think the whole world is watching as these indigenous members, you know, defend their land and their water. And you're right, the eminent domain principle really does, it's an extreme violation of your land rights as a landowner or as someone who's lived on that land for, you know, generations and generations before anyone colonized it. And it certainly does violate water rights. And I think that this lawsuit could definitely, you know, have a positive impact on ensuring that people's rights to their land and their water and their air are not violated by big banks and industry.
Yeah, and this is Julia, and I would just add to that that, you know, this is one example of fossil fuel infrastructure that is being proposed and built because we have a national energy system that is established by the Department of Energy and the U.S. government that is fossil fuel dependent. And right now about 81% of our energy supply comes from fossil fuels. And the Department of Energy knows that. It has plans to ensure the continued supply and production of fossil fuels to meet energy supply. And we have evidence in the case that we'll be talking about next week that, in fact, by 2040, the Department of Energy and the U.S. government still plan to have over three-quarters of the energy supply of our country fueled by fossil fuels. So this is very much controlled and facilitated by the U.S. government. And that is why this lawsuit on behalf of 21 people is attempting to address the affirmative acts of the U.S. government in really destroying the inalienable fundamental rights of young people and future generations, and certainly the indigenous rights of people in this country are also being severely affected by these localized projects and by the broader systemic problem.
Well, let's go back and Kelsey mentioned how did this lawsuit come about? How did you get involved in this?
Yeah, so I had been doing local climate activism, you know, since basically 11 years old, mostly with my classmates and in my school. And one of my heroes at the time was Alec Lors of iMatter organization. And when he was one of the first plaintiffs to participate in climate legal action with our Children's Trust when he filed a case out of California, and I was just so inspired by him. I'd heard him speak at the University of Oregon with Dr. James Hansen, and I was really inspired by that. And the fact that our Children's Trust is, you know, inspiring children, certainly in the United States, but international. I mean, they've sparked international cases based off of this atmospheric trust litigation principle, and so I was really excited to join this movement. And the Oregon State case that I've been a co-plaintiff on with Olivia Chernak, you know, is 5 years in the running. But there's no intention of me or her backing down until, you know, we are listened to by our state of Oregon, which is considered a leader among the other states. So I'm hoping that we see a positive result in the state of Oregon, and certainly the 21 youth who are on this case are fired up by the fact that we are united among, you know, cross country in seeking the same basic fundamental constitutional rights.
So it's basically a multi-pronged strategy. So you're basically, I assume the state lawsuits are essentially the same as the federal lawsuit in the sense that they're trying to get this, hold the states accountable on the similar grounds in terms of their energy policy and their whatever projects that the state is involved with have to take into account impacts on the climate. Is that right?
Yeah, this is Julia again, and that's exactly right. So all sovereign governments, whether it's a sovereign state within the United States or a sovereign nation state, all have obligations as trustees to their people to protect the types of resources that support life. So the traditional resources that have to be protected by sovereign governments include air and water, the seas and the shores of the sea, and wildlife. And so Kelsey mentioned the Oregon State case that's working its way through state court. It's actually on appeal. Kelsey and Olivia won the first round and then received a bad decision from the trial court. So we're appealing that decision and hope to have an oral argument in that in the next 6 months. And that case is about holding the state of Oregon accountable for its public trust obligations to the plaintiffs. The federal case, which is also here in Oregon Federal Court in Eugene, is about holding the U.S. government accountable for not only its public trust responsibilities over national resources like air, the atmosphere, and our oceans, but it's also to uphold and protect the Fifth Amendment constitutional rights of these young people to life, liberties, property. They have fundamental rights, and what's happening is their government, for the past six decades, essentially, has been taking affirmative actions that puts them in a very dangerous situation. And even under the Obama administration, the government is continuing to enhance that danger. And we're seeing the ramifications of that. And I'll just give you one example. One of our plaintiffs, her name is Jaden. She's 13. She lives in southern Louisiana. And in the last couple of weeks, she was flooded. She literally woke up in the morning, and in her words, she stepped right into climate change. She was ankle deep in water in her bedroom and had a river of sewage water and storm waters flowing through her home. Her personal security, her life, and her property have been threatened, and that was a 1,000-year storm event, unprecedented flooding in an area that is supposedly outside of the floodplain. So we're seeing the very significant ramifications of the federal government's actions on these plaintiffs right now. The harm is happening right now.
So you mentioned the public trust. Now, explain a little bit that. What's the basis of this, the public trust doctrine, as it were?
The public trust doctrine goes back to like 500 something BC, ancient Roman times. And it's this extremely fundamental basic principle that the government, as you know, this body of ruling members who make decisions, critical decisions on behalf of all its people and you know, generations to come, has a duty, a responsibility to protect basic resources needed for survival that include land, access to land and water, and as Julia said, wildlife. Those are all recognized under public trust doctrine rulings today. You know, the government has a legal obligation to protect those basic natural resources for the use and the survivable requirements and need of all people living today and people, you know, down the line who are not alive today to make those critical decisions on whether or not they will have access to those survival, you know, needs and requirements later on. So the public trust is a really fundamental principle that ensures that youth are respected and considered when making critical decisions on behalf of the natural environment and resources that all creatures rely on for life.
So let me ask the lawyer in the room here, Julia, to kind of expand on that. So, but how does the public trust doctrine exist within the legal system today, and how can it affect? How can it be brought to bear in the case in particular that we're dealing with?
Yeah, that's a good question. The public trust doctrine in the United States actually came to the original 13 states through the King of England, and then the original 13 states created the U.S. government through our Constitution. And so the law from those ancient times passed to our U.S. governments in that way. And so many states actually have written the public trust doctrine into constitutions. States and the federal government have written the public trust doctrine into statutory laws. And then there are all of these judicial decisions from our courts, both at the federal level and at state levels, that have affirmed that this law is integral and an historic part of American law. And so you can find it literally in thousands of legal documents in our country. And it's a very active body of law. It's used to protect navigable waterways. It's used to protect coastlines in places like North Carolina. And what we are doing now in using the public trust doctrine to address climate change is it's not really a new application of the law, it's just a new circumstance, right? So the atmosphere and our waterways are integrally connected. In fact, a judge in the state of Washington, Judge Hill, recently decided a case in favor of 8 of our plaintiffs up in Washington. And what she said is that the atmosphere and our waters are inextricably linked, and it's basically silly to say that they're not connected and that harming one doesn't harm the other. And so we're applying the public trust doctrine to the atmosphere and to the waters and the oceans and saying that governments are essentially causing irreversible impairment or harm to those resources by continuing to allow unsafe levels of carbon dioxide pollution specifically, but also other greenhouse gas pollution. And that's a violation of their trust responsibility to young people and to all future generations. Because what we're talking about here is not, a temporary chemical spill. We're not talking about things that can be remediated. We're talking about irreversible damage to the stability of our climate system on which all life depends. And as Dr. Hansen says, we're talking about time scales that humans could never reverse the situation. You know, time scales that humans care about are being irreversibly damaged if we don't decrease our carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas pollution immediately.
You know, I had this kind of terrible thought in a way last night as I was listening to that song, To Be or Not To Be. I was thinking that the what happened again on Saturday with the construction or destruction equipment going in and destroying, leapfrogging miles over where they had been working, and specifically targeting, apparently, an area that had just been identified to the court the day before in attempt to get them to issue an injunction on the work so they wouldn't impact those burial sites and prayer sites and whatever was there. And they went in and just apparently knowingly did it. And we have experience of that in the Pacific Northwest in years of struggling to protect our forests, where, we were, going to go into court on a Monday and the timber companies would go in on the weekend. I remember at least one famous Easter Sunday that they went in and logged the whole site, and it ends up in court and the judge declares it moot. So my terrible thought is, it's like we're talking about some big things, big questions here, the entire climate, the future of the planet. I mean, it's like, yes, we have to act before, will there even be a judge to decide such things if we don't actually curtail these emissions?
Right. Well, so in the case of climate destabilization, it's critical that a judge acts today to uphold these fundamental rights and ensure the longevity of our public trust resources, because the damage is being done today, even though the full ramifications, as you indicated, won't be felt until the future, when generations later and after us won't be able to reverse the problem. So it's a very unique issue, but it is alike or akin to the destruction of sacred lands and important, just incredibly important sites for indigenous and native peoples. And as you know, it happens consistently, and often it happens in the name of fossil fuel development. So I think it's one reason why we're seeing so many movements come together to fight what's happening to our climate system, because underlying it all is a greater travesty of destruction of so many places and sacred sites that are important to people with very deep-rooted traditions. And so it's all tied together. It's all very tied together. And I know Kelsey probably can talk about the relationship and correlation with protecting forests in Oregon. Her family has deep roots in that area as well.
In fact, I know her parents. In fact, I knew her parents during the times I'm talking about, actually. If Katya and Tim are listening, hi. And anyway, I am speaking with Julia Olson, the lead attorney of our Children's Trust, in this unique, some say unprecedented, certainly landmark case, 21 youth versus the United States. And we'll talk about exactly what the lawsuit is trying to accomplish as we go along here. And I'm also speaking with Kelsey Juliana, who you just heard laugh there, who is one of the 21 youth plaintiffs. The number to call in is 503 231-8187. We only have one line open because we got two lines being occupied here by our guests from Eugene. So have patience. And if you call early, you will be more likely to be get in. And Kelsey, talk about that if you want, those relationships, and also about what it's been like being involved in this case.
Yeah, well, I will say regarding, the Oregon forest to which I'm named after and which my parents, met trying to protect some of the last old growth in this area and in actually our nation, they were speaking about climate change, back then. Back in the 90s, they were looking at the effects of deforestation on our climate and what that would mean to take away these beautiful, special old-growth forests that make up the, beautiful bioregion of Cascadia and the rest of Oregon's really diverse ecosystems. And they were looking at, just the shame in taking away these beautiful forests, but also what they would look to the rest of the world. Old-growth forests are some of our best sequesters of carbon dioxide emissions. And so you're not only harming the planet by taking away these beautiful, trees that prevent contamination of streams and other, I'm forgetting the word.
Destruction of the habitat-dependent species.
Habitat loss,
yeah.
Exactly. But you're also taking away massive sequesters of carbon. And so my parents were talking about climate change back in the 90s, and certainly we're talking about it today. And when we look at what we're asking for in these legal cases, we're looking at a halt to the way that we view infrastructure and fossil fuel use and just the rubber stamping that our government has a very long and unhealthy relationship to doing in our nation. And we're also looking at, aiming at bringing in sequesters. And so not only halting the use of the extreme use of fossil fuels and that hunger, but working at, bringing back our forests and aiming at sequestering some of the carbon that is already emitted and that will last for hundreds of years.
So essentially, among, in addition to having to completely relook at such infrastructure projects as pipelines and fossil fuel export terminals, the federal government, through the Bureau of Land Management and the Department of Agriculture, U.S. Forest Service, would have to look at their forest practices, and the state of Oregon, through its state forests, would have to look at its forest practices, is basically what you're saying. Through these public trust doctrine, through these lawsuits that you all are bringing forward.
Yes, that is correct.
So talk about, specifically, while we're waiting for people to call in at 503-231-8187, talk about what the specific ask is. What is this lawsuit concretely attempting to do, Julia?
Sure. Well, so the first step is for the court to recognize that these youth have fundamental rights under the U.S. Constitution and that the government has a public trust obligation. So say what the law is. That's the first thing that courts do. And then the second piece, which is the injunctive relief request, we're seeking something really straightforward that courts throughout history have required, and that is that the government prepare a comprehensive plan for how it is going to redress or remedy the constitutional violations. And so what that means in this case is the federal defendants, which are primarily agencies of the federal government and departments, such as the Department of Energy and the Environmental Protection Agency and the president, they would come up with a plan that would look at the energy system of the United States and figure out how to best transition the energy system away from fossil fuels and towards renewable energy and forms of energy that do not destabilize the climate system. And then the court would require that plan to be submitted to the court, and it would oversee implementation of that plan. And that piece is really important, because if you look back at the times of desegregation, the courts really stepped in not only to review the plans that the governments were preparing to desegregate schools, but if they weren't adequate, they sent them back. Sometimes the courts got involved in writing the plans, and ultimately they ensured that they were implemented. The same is true of reforming the prison systems in places like California, where prisoners' rights had been violated, and courts ordered that prisoner populations be reduced by a specific amount in order to protect the rights of prisoners. And I literally have cases going back hundreds of years where courts have really engaged in the kind of systemic reform that's needed to uphold constitutional rights. For people in the Pacific Northwest who are familiar with the issues with protecting salmon and the controversies that have arisen, the courts have been deeply involved in trying to protect and save salmon. And that has involved very significant planning, allocation of resources. And so these are things courts do all of the time, and we're asking the court to use its equitable authority under the Constitution to ensure that these plaintiffs' rights are protected.
Well, we do have a caller, so let's go to our first caller. Harvey, you're on the air.
Hi, Paul. Thank you very much for the show, and hello, Julia and Kelsey. These things have far-reaching effects, more than we know. Well, first of all, in biblical times, the enemy would come in and they'd salt the fields and poison the wells, and that's what they do to try to kill everything. And so here we have these international petroleum companies. They're basically fracking the groundwater. They're poisoning our groundwater. And and they use chemicals like benzene, which are known carcinogens. So they're really they are the enemy to us and future generations. At the same time, the heating up of our atmosphere with the introduction of we're pumping so much CO2 into our atmosphere that it's melting the polar caps. And when the polar caps melt, that gives rise to larger and more tectonic plate movements on the planet, which could trigger a earthquake on the Cascadia subduction zone. These subduction zones create the largest earthquakes on the planet, a mega earthquake of 0.9 magnitude that could completely destroy the West Coast. And so This is where we're going with all this pumping of so much CO2 into the atmosphere, plus the fracking actually is known to cause earthquakes. So we're everything's right on the line here, and it's change or die as far as I'm concerned. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. There are, as you say, many issues involved with fossil fuel extraction and production and combustion that are harming us in so many different ways, and particularly threatening future generations. And this case against the United States, when we win, it will really compel the kind of systemic change that we need to protect the life support system of our nation, and really lead, I think, to nations around the world shifting course and following the lead of the United States, which we all know is essential.
Well, again, I'm talking with Julia Olson, lead attorney on this case, with Our Children's Trust, and a youth plaintiff, Kelsey Juliana. Number to call in is 503-231-8187. You know, I just had this flash. You know, back in the day, when we're talking about the efforts in the 80s and 90s to stop the forest devastation that was going on, and still continues, we must say, but slowed down at the time in a dramatic way for a while. But largely what we were doing, because we certainly didn't think we were going to permanently protect in areas by sitting in trees and locking ourselves to bulldozers and all that. But a lot of what we were doing was trying to hold them off until our day in court. And as I said, a lot of times they knew that too. And so they would come in and cut the forests before we could get into court. So in a way, you know, this rising climate movement is kind of like on a planetary scale or continental scale. In the case of North America, you know, kind of doing the same thing, you know, while we're trying to change the way that pipelines are regulated, end the madness of considering them public utilities, as you heard on anybody listening to Democracy Now!, the guy from Iowa who's talking about the abuse of eminent domain, which also, you know, people were fighting the liquefied natural gas terminal in Coos Bay. And there's some landowners that actually objected to the use of eminent domain and won temporarily because they couldn't at that point demonstrate public benefit. Very complicated issues, but I think these are some of the most crucial issues that I can see going on right now that we really need to pay attention to. Do you have any further comments on this? Maybe you have some reaction to what I just said, Kelsey.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that because a lot of the community I was raised with, I was actually born in Fall Creek, Oregon, out in the forest, and just outside of Eugene.
You're a real wild child.
Yeah, kind of. But a lot of the community that I was born, that I grew up with, you know, I totally idealized them. Wow, like these people, they went out there and they stood in the forest and they saved the forest. And it is really the case in our history where we have seen grassroots organizing, we've seen children walking out of schools, we've seen parents join, you know, coalitions and speak about, you know, destruction in their neighborhoods or contamination of their local waters and soils. We've seen, you know, mass mobilization and in the streets. We have seen civil disobedience, and we have gone to court. And so it is really this very multifaceted movement that is historically, you know, secured civil rights and advocated for basic needs and who have fought for injustice. And so we're kind of seeing that with this climate movement. I mean, here we have young people who cannot vote, who are trying to exercise one of the only branches of government that they have real access to, which is the judicial system, going to court. And so you have young people, you know, as young as 9, who are sitting not only in front of a representative of the Department of Justice of their federal government, but who are also sitting in front of representatives of the entire fossil fuel industry, of this massive international, you know, corporation who is doing everything in their power to keep their industry, which directly harms and negatively affects the interests of us youth, of wildlife, of every generation to come. And so we have children who are, you know, getting, you know, things started in their schools and who are, you know, getting things started in their local communities and who are sitting, you know, in court and asking for judges to recognize their fundamental inalienable rights to life, liberty, property, and the, you know, the need to breathe and to drink water that is clean and free of toxins. And so it really is this incredible movement that is definitely an intergenerational fight, but is very much led and inspired by youth, not only who are acting today, but, you know, I know I'm certainly motivated by the idea of the youth to come and of my future children. Well, so it's really this incredible movement, and that's the case of history. We've seen, you know, incredible work goes through our court systems to secure justice and civil rights.
We have another caller. Mark, hold on just a second. I just want to say that coming up this morning, KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, host Linda Olson-Osterlund interviews Rachel Maripol, attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights about the recent reinstatement of their lawsuit against the Bureau of Prisons for the assignment of prisoners to secretive units called CMUs, along the lines you were talking about earlier, Julia. Slightly different topic than the limiting numbers of prisoners in California, but at least equally as urgent. Anyway, thanks to all of our KBOO members for all of your generous support. And if you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. And of course, if you do that, a lot of you do that, we can shorten our membership drive, which is coming up next week. So, Mark, you're our next caller. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. Thanks for a great program, very life-giving in view of the fact that our government is polarized and paralyzed by a prophet worship. That the state needs to become needs to represent the public interest, and yet is caught in privatization, deregulation. There's a court decision. A court overturned Canada's approval of the Northern Gateway pipeline on June 30th. And you can read about this on CanadianProgressiveWorld.com. They denounced the Harper government for dismantling environmental laws and ruled that the First Nations people had a right to be involved in government decision-making and that they were flagrantly ignored. So this is kind of a life-giving decision.
Well, that's kind of like what we're looking for in the Dakota Access case,
yes.
something
yes.
exactly analogous.
Exactly, mm-hmm. And you know, just as we need to redefine business so it goes beyond profit maximization, so we have to redefine the government's agenda, you know. And thanks for your passion and for your guests who are doing what is absolutely necessary unless we are to fall into a corporate feudalism.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. You know, that's interesting. I was thinking about, you know, they're talking about the public trust doctrine. Then if you look at the kind of the origins of how corporations were chartered, you know, there was sort of an element that they had to have an actual public utility. Otherwise, they could be, their charter could be revoked. And there, you know, was a sort of a nascent movement to revoke corporate charters back when the whole anti-globalization movement was kind of picking up steam in the 90s. And of course, that's still the case. But this, again, this is exactly what we're talking about with these pipelines, and with the, you know, with this lawsuit is trying to reinstate a sense of what are governments for, if not to actually guarantee the security and well-being of its members.
That's exactly right, and it's interesting, this issue of monopolization. One of the principles of the public trust is an anti-monopolization principle over public resources. Another principle of the public trust that's really important is a duty of loyalty. So our government representatives have a duty of loyalty to the people, not to short-term economic interests. And I just want to read you one quote from Judge Coffin's decision from April of this year, which denied the defendant's motions to dismiss in our case, and which is now being reviewed by Judge Ann Aiken. And Judge Coffin wrote, "The intractability of the debates before Congress and state legislatures and the alleged valuing of short-term economic interests despite the cost to human life necessitates a need for the courts to evaluate the constitutional parameters of the action or inaction taken by the government." And then he went on to talk about the disparate impact to young people and future generations, where government is literally discounting the lives of future generations and valuing present lives and economic interests more. And it's really time that courts do their duty in democracy and act as a check against the political branches of government. Because we aren't just a government of two branches. We are a government of three branches. And when it comes to climate change and the incredible emergency we are in right now, it is essential that courts step in and act as a check and uphold constitutions and public trust rights for all citizens. And in this case, the young plaintiffs bringing forward this case and who will be with me in court on September 13th here in Eugene, Oregon, they are standing for the harms that they are receiving, the harms that they are living with presently because of climate destabilization. But they are also standing for children everywhere. They're standing for future generations. And, you know, anyone in Oregon who wants to stand with them in court on September 13th will be at the Wayne Morse Federal Courthouse at 10 a.m., but come early, I anticipate there will be a lot of people there to support these youth.
You know, I wanted to get into that a little more about the, I know I talked to Kelsey briefly after that, the court hearing, I guess it was April 9th, I believe, and you talked a little bit about what it was like to for the youth defendants to face this long row of corporate lawyers, corporate and government lawyers. Must have been a quite the scene. I want to talk a little bit about the court's process. I'm glad you brought that up about, you know, Judge Coffin's ruling, because, you know, a lot of times we don't really, you know, think about, you know, that there's these the judges who are ruling on these cases are, you know, they're people and they have training and they're, you know, they sometimes they actually come up with a really, you know, good, sound decisions, well thought out, I guess I meant to say. You know, they actually think these things through. So it's interesting to see how that plays out. Like, let's talk about that in the last 15 minutes. But first, we've got Karen on the line. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you for giving me a moment. I'm so grateful.
We can't hear you at all unless you're able to get a...
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now better?
A little better, yeah.
I'm so grateful for all the people who stand up and are taking issue to this, and especially the issue about the three branches of government and the federal courts being one of them. I think oftentimes we forget that, and it's so critical. And I hope the judges realize the importance and the critical role that they're playing in the conservation of our environment. I know, especially like now with the protests that's going on the Native Indian realms, and so much of the oil pipelines is for export. And then why export? You know, why? And then I realized, I mean, we have hundreds and hundreds of military bases around the world. So, I mean, how do we fuel those bomber planes? How do we fuel the drones? How do we fuel the war machines? And, of course, petroleum. So, I mean, they export it to these countries, and then they essentially buy back at really cheap rates, or they export the oil just for their own use in military bases around the world. And, I mean, even our own government spends 58% of tax dollar money on building up military, and these wars have to absolutely stop. It's just profiteering, and it's absolutely disgusting. So that's my comment.
Hear, hear. Julia, Kelsey?
Yeah, I'll just respond on the import-export issue. And you're exactly right that the import-export system of fossil fuels in our country is really about the profits of a private industry. So we import right now more than we export, but you'll see, I've looked at the maps and you'll see we'll be exporting natural gas or oil from one port, and we're importing it back from another country to the same port. So it's really a system of profit that's set up. And really importantly, for everyone out there listening, under the Obama administration and projected out for decades, we are going to become a net exporter of oil and natural gas. We have plans in place right now not only to increase production to the highest levels in U.S. history so that we can continue to use fossil fuels as our primary energy source, but we have plans to become a net exporter, to send those fuels abroad to be burned in other countries as well. And that is the plan of the U.S. federal government right now, and that has to shift and completely transition to a system of renewable energy.
Yeah, the whole idea of the much-touted idea of energy independence. is just one of those many canards to deflect our attention from those the shell game of what's really going on. If there's any last callers who want to get in, 503-231-8187 might be able to take one last caller. Do it now. So, yeah, Kelsey, talk a little, you know, again about that experience on April 9th and the overall experience. So, you were a minor, I believe, when you started your first court battle against with the state of Oregon, and now you're I understand, a college student. And you're the oldest of the 21 plaintiffs. You mentioned people as young as nine involved. There's a range of ages. Talk about what it was like to be in that courtroom, in front of, and Julia too, for that matter. I'm sure it must have been an interesting experience going up against these hardened veterans of the legal world. So what was it like in court in Eugene back in April?
Well, what I can say is I think we were all pretty, and by all I mean everyone in that courtroom, everyone in that courthouse, and across the nation, we were all pretty impressed, and honestly, I wasn't that surprised to see the show of support from the community. We had busloads of youth from Portland and the Eugene area arrived. We had every single courtroom in that courthouse packed in overflow. We had live stream in the Portland courthouse. We had, I think 60 fifth graders in matching t-shirts. It takes everything to change everything like that. It takes everyone to change everything. And, with giant banners and images of species and wildlife that they want to protect. So it was just this incredible show of people of all ages and coming from all over to stand and witness history being made. And really quick to talk a little bit more about the Obama administration. Regarding climate change, Obama recently said that he believes history will judge today's efforts as pivotal. And I can't agree more. I think we are at a pivotal moment in history where we are standing at an urgency in asking if our government, our elected leaders who are employed to work and speak and act on behalf of its people and of its citizens and of its land, we are at a pivotal moment where they need to look at themselves critically and ask, who do they represent and who do they work for? Do they work for their own profits and their own self-interest? Do they work for the multi-million dollar corporations for oil, for gas, for coal, or do they work for its people, for its youth, for its children, for its animals, and for its land? And that's what we're looking for. And so, Obama, you're right. We are at a pivotal moment of urgency, and we're looking at you to help define that. This time in who you represent and who our government represents from this day forward.
Well, I just got to interject before maybe Julia wants to add something, but I was thinking about those images of the those dogs, those guard dogs, attack dogs, basically, that were biting the Native Americans. There's images side by side now that are making the rounds of the internet from 1953 in either Birmingham or Selma. And right next, exactly the same image, the dogs tearing into the clothes and or flesh of the human beings on the one side, African Americans, on the other, Native Americans. And, to me, this is a moment, this is a Kennedy moment. This is, Obama is in the position of the Kennedy administration in the civil rights era, where they're, forced, they're confronted with this thing. I mean, I personally don't see Obama rising to the moral challenge like Kennedy ultimately did, but who knows? Maybe I'll be proven wrong.
Well, we would definitely offer to President Obama to rise to that challenge and leave a legacy that he can be proud of. And at this point, that's not the case. And he continues, along with the other defendants in the case, to fight the youth in court on every argument they're making. In their briefs by the Department of Justice, they contend that these young plaintiffs do not have constitutional rights. They say that the federal government has no public trust obligation to protect vital natural resources. They even suggested, in response to a question by Judge Coffin, that it might be okay for the federal government to sell off the Pacific Ocean to an oil company. So the positions they're taking in this case...
That was a hypothetical presented?
Yeah, it was a hypothetical presented. And the interveners jumped on it immediately. The fossil fuel defendant interveners said, yes, absolutely, the U.S. can sell the Pacific Ocean to an oil company, which isn't a surprising response, but it's surprising when you hear it coming from the Department of Justice. It's really shocking. That was one of the shocking moments in the courtroom that day. I think overall it was a very exciting hearing. Judge Coffin was incredibly well-prepared and thoughtful and really asked good, hard questions to all of the attorneys in the case. And I expect the same thing will happen with Judge Aiken on September 13th. So we're very much looking forward to it. These are big, important questions that implicate the U.S. Constitution, democracy, the future of our nation, the safety of our children, and we know that the court will very carefully consider all of the arguments.
So has there ever been a case, anything like this, that has gone as far as this one has?
A climate change case like this?
Yeah. Or a sweep, like a sweeping environment. When was the last time a sweeping environmental case brought into the fore such fundamental constitutional questions?
Well, it's interesting. In the United States, our environmental law world has really been focused on our statutory law. So the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and the Endangered Species Act, laws that Congress enacted to try to protect these resources. But as Professor Mary Wood writes about in her book, Nature's Trust, what has happened is the agencies that were supposed to be the trustees and responsible for protecting our natural resources have become, in large part, agents of private interests and industry that want to exploit our natural resources. And so the system has not worked the way it should have worked. And the executive branch has used its discretion under those statutes to really allow and cause the harm that we're seeing today to the climate system. And what's fundamentally at stake are constitutional rights. And that's why this is a constitutional case. It is not an environmental case. It's not a statutory case. This is about inalienable rights that these young people hold.
Well, on that note, that excellent note, we have to go. So thank you so much for being with us. Julia Olson, lead attorney in the Youth v. U.S. Government case, and Kelsey Giuliana, one of the plaintiffs in the case. Thank you so much. Good luck.
Thanks so much for having us.
All right.
Thank you.
Goodbye. And on that note, we got to get out of here. Again, a fundraiser for Sacred Stone Camp this evening. Yes, this evening, 6 to 7:30 at Peninsula Park, North Ainsworth and Albina. Be there. September 13th coming up next week is this landmark case. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned for Linda Olson Osterlund. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Die, capitalism must die.
And leave the Arctic sound.
Sustainability
and an end to this insanity
and an answer to the question.